2SER
107.3. Hello and welcome. Thank you so much for joining me. You are on 2SER 107.3. Now, my name is Andrew Popel, and this show is called Final Draft. Now, if you've not joined me on Final Draft previously, the clue's in the name. This is books, writing, and literary culture. I hope I'm finding you well. Even better, I hope I'm finding you with a book. Thank you so much for taking the time to, you know, pop it down, pop the bookmark in, and join me as we discover some of the greatest and latest in Australian literary fiction. I have got a fantastic book for you today, but I mean, how is your reading life going? It's always exciting at the beginning of the year, but this year I've been really kind of grabbed at the idea of reading back. I've been, you know, wanting to revisit some Henry James, and I've just started reading some Jane Austen. I don't know, it feels a bit anachronistic to me, but some free and direct prose is exactly what I need. But today I've got a book that plays with perspective. And look, before we get started, and before I tell you who I'm going to be introducing you today, I want to acknowledge that 2SER is broadcasting from the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. Now, I am recording up in the Blue Mountains. I am recording on Darugan Gundungurra land, and I want to acknowledge the traditional owners of those lands. I want to acknowledge their ongoing connection to those lands, that it is stolen land. The treaty was never reached in Australia. It always was and always will be Aboriginal land. Now, today on the show, as I said, I've got a book that plays with ideas, it plays with perspective, and it's really, I mean, it got me thinking, and I hope it gets you thinking. Ian Ryan, he is the author of two Ned Kelly Award shortlisted novels, and his third, The Spiral, is an absolute triumph of thought and ideas and action. The Spiral takes us to a university campus where Irma has been called back to answer disciplinary charges, but very quickly she is thrown in the deep end. And look, I'm going to let Ian introduce a little bit more of the book. Suffice to say that in my broader reading world, where I've been looking for different ways to challenge my own perspectives, Ian's use of first and second person, Ian's use of narrative technique, and really drawing the reader in has got me enthralled. I hope I've also got you intrigued, because coming up after this very short break, we're going to be delving into Ian Ryan's The Spiral.
2SER wishes to acknowledge the custodians of the land from which we broadcast, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and the Wadumatagal clan of the Darug Nation, and their elders past, present and emerging. We acknowledge and respect their continuing culture and the contribution they make to the life of this city and this region.
You're on 2SER 107.3. It is Final Draft time. My name is Andrew Popel, and today on the show, I have got a fantastic author you have met before, Ian Ryan. He is the Ned Kelly shortlisted author of 4 Days and The Student. Long-time listeners of the show will remember when Ian joined us to discuss The Student, and today we have got a fantastic new novel that just defied my expectations, and I'm so excited to bring it to you. It is called The Spiral. Ian, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hi, Andrew. Thanks for having me back.
You're very welcome. As I said, the idea of this conversation excites me because The Spiral just opens up so many ideas. But I just want to introduce the book. Irma Bridges is tired. She just got off a red eye to answer as yet unknown charges of misconduct from her university. A university where Irma's writing a book on the history of reader-deployed young adult fiction. That's choose-your-own-adventure books, if you remember them. A university where young women are disappearing at an alarming rate. A university where one young woman, Irma's missing research assistant, is about to reappear and brutally attack Irma for seemingly no discernible reason. In The Spiral, it felt both grounded and high concept. I'm so excited to get into these ideas. It's also worth noting, though, there is so much going on in the spiral that I'm going to have to work really hard to avoid spoiling any of the surprises in your entwined narratives of a kickboxing academic and an androgynous barbarian. And yes, dear listener, you heard that correctly. I want to start us off with Irma. And acknowledging that there is a whole nother barbarian narrative that we will get to. You start off at a breakneck pace. So Irma from page one is reacting. She's seemingly on instinct, sort of maybe to kicking in with some of her Muay Thai training there. She's reacting to the disciplinary meeting, to Jenny's disappearance, to her research going off the rails. She's doing what she has to do to keep going, but it's not like she has much choice, at least on the surface. And there, I started to think that seems like a bit of a key here. Did you want to explore this world of extremes and how they impact on our choices?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the name of the game, really. The hard-boiled sort of noir crime fiction that I'm most drawn to almost always puts the protagonist in this headspace. Sometimes towards the end of the novel, but I'm a real fan of this UK writer called David Peace, who seems to, you know, really quickly get the character into an unstable. It's almost like the character starts in a bad place and then goes completely off the deep end by the end of the novels. And I just find it a fascinating kind of headspace to work with as a writer, to put people under this kind of pressure and see what happens. And I'm also dealing with an academic, which I can say this because I am an academic. If I just sort of started it in the routine everyday life of academia, I don't think it would make for much of an opening to a thriller.
So you also have a barbarian.
I do.
Sarah emerges when Irma is unconscious, either sleeping or, insert dramatic pause here, Sarah seems to embody violence, but violence with a purpose. And Sarah is also an extension of the stories that Irma loved as a child. It has to do with the narratives that she's exploring through the book that she's writing. Do you think stories influence and embody ourselves in our subconscious mind in that way? Like, do you have an internal barbarian that emerges when you go to sleep?
Not a barbarian, but, and I admittedly don't, for someone who has just written a book so invested in like an unconscious narrative, I don't dream a great deal myself. Like, it's not a strong sort of part of my day-to-day life. I was just curious about, like, how Irma would deal with the situation that she had, and her investment in narrative as both like a personal thing with her backstory as a sort of avid reader of these choose your own adventure and fighting fantasy novels, and the way that she is trying to kind of control her narrative and trying to sort of, she's in a very like unstable, chaotic space in her life. And yet she's trying to like kind of control it. It just made sense to me that in her unconscious that there would be a narrative that she was sort of trying to impose over that in some way. And I have to be completely honest, I can't remember the exact origin of why I decided it was a good idea to put this stuff about the fantasy barbarian into the novel. But as soon as I started doing it and found the voice for the Cero sections, I started to really get into it. Like, you know, I mean, maybe it's self-serving, but I really liked writing about a hard-boiled sort of high fantasy world. I thought it was really curious. really, I just personally just, I was like, this is odd. It seems odd to me, but I'm into it.
I had not thought about the hard-boiled elements so much as I was looking at, I guess the way you were playing with unconscious, but also the way, I mean, by the end of the novel, we come to appreciate how brilliantly layered Cero is in terms of being, I guess, almost an alter ego for Irma.
Cero is definitely represents something. So, and it's something that needs to be explored and brought to the forefront of Irma's story. And it became a really valid way, in my opinion, to sort of to tell that to describe that journey, really. That's what it got to. And I couldn't think of a... Once I had the ball rolling, it almost became like I couldn't think of any other way to do it. Mm. And I, you know, admittedly, I was sort of just feeling my way through some parts of it as well. I wasn't really 100% sure how I was going to tell the story, but it all seemed to be working. And it was really over the course of edits and rewrites that I was able to kind of, you know, bring, I suppose, some of my own sort of subconscious and unconscious ideas together in a more kind of compact way, which is one of the themes of the novel.
I was just really going to say, I love the way the motif of choice and control extends so far as to your original drafting and then in through your editing process. Irma's research then, so she's writing a book on reader-deployed young adult fiction, and we've talked about the Choose Your Own Adventure books a little bit. I loved them when I was a kid. I'd variously read them in earnest, so I would be a strict rule follower. I would go back and then explore, so, all right, what choice didn't I take? And then just the outright cheating, which I know you do also discuss in The Spiral. So I did love later on in The Spiral when you dive into your own Choose Your Own Adventure scenario. It struck me, though, this segment of the novel is always destined to land at the same place. Page 235 inevitably arrives and the story regains a somewhat linear momentum. So now, in this section, you've turned the lens on the reader and we must become responsible for the choices. How do you think that might affect the typical reader? Are readers looking for choice, or do they actually like that narratives give them an escape from that responsibility?
That's the tension that I'm really, it's one of the tensions, sorry, that I'm like most interested in exploring in the book. I mean, control and fate is the other sort of side of that dynamic that I'm interested in. And that almost started off as my own questions about it. I mean, yeah, it sounds very odd, but I did, you know, you can tell when you get really into the guts of the book, that it is a story about an author trying to understand their own process and their own desire for control. I mean, writing a novel is a very controlling thing to do with your spare time, but there's no doubt about it. And that aspect of the controlling impulse, it only manifests in that part of my life. In the rest of my life, I am pretty chill. And yet when I write these novels, it seems to be entirely about control. Like, I outline them. I'm sort of meticulous in the way that I edit them. I, you know, just about everyone that I've ever turned a novel over to sort of remarks on how clean the manuscript is, because I just can't, it's just all about dominating the manuscript, really, and beating it and having it be this thing that I'm completely, you know, completely satisfied with in some sort of capacity. And yeah, and then, you know, as I was moving through it, I had questions. I somehow got through that and started to get through, you know, and start to think, well, you know, the reader wants control as well. Like the reader, especially in these, you know, Choose Your Own Adventure novels, it sort of gives you, it sort of lends that weird promise that you're going to get some of the control back from the author. And then when you really think about it, that absolutely doesn't happen. Like the branches of the narrative are completely pre-programmed by the author to go to like various destinations. So it seemed to like completely fit with the broader theme of the book.
Can we get then into this, narrative perspective? The way you have written this novel and the way that it gets into our heads as we read, because that's key to Sarah's narrative. It's key to that section of choice, because Irma's story is narrated in the first person. She's not always the most likable person, but we are drawn to, or at least compelled to relate to her as we have all of her interior thoughts and justifications. And I think that sort of interiority invites us to identify. But Sarah is us. Second person, gender neutral, Sarah invites this direct identification despite the entirely alien circumstance. So what does narrative perspective mean to you when you're writing those characters? And did you want to use it? Like, how did you use it to get into our heads?
I Well, yeah, the first person present tense narrative style is just, in my experience, very effective at building that empathy because, yeah, I mean, it's just happening right now inside your in the character's head. I mean, there's virtually, it's like a brute force type of empathy. Like it can't, you know, there's virtually, you know, even if you don't like the character, you're just 100% there like the whole time. Like, and I knew that Irma would be tricky, and I had tried to write the novel in different voices. Like I think I tried, I probably got like maybe 10 or 15,000 words in a different narrative style, and it just didn't work. I was really overly cautious about repeating myself with the student, which was written in a similar voice. But then I, you know, it just didn't work, and I kind of reverted back to what I thought would be effective. And in terms of the second person stuff, that, yeah, that took a bit of getting to, but it really was, because, you know, when you tell people that there's a section of your novel that's in second person, it can elicit a bit of an eye roll, because that is probably, in the grand hierarchy of things, one of the least favored narrative styles is the second person. It's like, if you can read literary like textbooks and manuals about writing that explicitly tell you never to write in that style, but you know, once I'd kind of committed to the idea that it was going to have this choose your own adventure component in it, that locked me, you know, I felt, into the second person. And then that itself started to raise some pretty interesting questions about, you know, the reader's culpability and like what I could do with that. Like, when, you know, when I'm directly addressing the reader, it, you know, I could sort of subtly suggest things, move some of my own shame and guilt onto their plate, so to speak.
It's strange. It feels like it should be something that automatically puts identification on the reader, but it is, as you say, it's this really tricky area where it can just result in a complete kind of pushback, revile away from this invasion, because you're making us, we are Sarah, we are walking and making decisions and ultimately getting very, very complicated in parts of the narrative that I'm not going to spoil.
Yeah, I think, I mean, we can talk abstractly about the fact that Sarah represents violence, and if there's sort of a central kind of takeaway from the book in terms of what I'm saying about human nature, is that I feel that the capacity for violence is in all of us. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, and that's sort of what Sarah represents. Like, I'm trying to sort of suggest, I suppose, that, you know, that the reader, you know, should start to at least consider their own culpability with the degree to which, you know, violence is enticing and dramatic, and that, you know, that there's a desire to read it and see it, and all of these kinds of issues when they're riding along with this character that increasingly enters these violent scenarios.
Can I complicate this a little bit? Because I was really intrigued by the way Sarah's narrative is marked by a search for self. The barbarian has no memory of who they are, and this quest, it's single-minded, it's brutal. Seros is basically slaying anyone who gets in their way or might, you know, be able to be a stepping stone to finding who they are. But Sarah's also surprisingly vulnerable to those who might offer a solution. So I just wondered how Sarah's behaviors kind of reflected on feelings and dynamics of power, that in a sense being so dominating but then also powerless and vulnerable.
Yeah, I think that's kind of what violence is, though. I mean, it is dominating, and then it is just coarse and chaotic and not very useful, like with outside the scope of its own desires, really. I mean, he's wandering that fantasy or that unconscious landscape looking for something.
I want to come back to the reader. I was really interested as you were as you call it, misgendering Sarah there. One of the things you invite is this radical reader identification. Like, the spiral involves the reader through the empathy of the first person narrative, through the sort of the dragging. You know, it's like you've put your fist outside of the book and pulled us in with Sarah's second person narrative. You've given us our own choices. You offer the reader the power of choice precisely at the moment Irma is completely denied choice and agency. You balance this lack of external agency with ideas of internal choice, this sort of movement towards perspective and personal insight. And I think, again, that's for so many readers, that's why they come to reading. They're looking for insight and perspective in another story that might give them insight on themselves. Were you? I mean, this feels like a very open, inviting, but then discomforting book for the reader. And I was really wondering, like, was that something you were hoping to highlight?
Yeah, absolutely. I have those feelings about myself, as I discussed earlier, about what it means to write, whether it's even like a noble act or a moral act, or I feel uncomfortable with the idea that the author is necessarily doing a productive and worthwhile moral sort of thing. I don't think that we're monsters, but I don't readily accept the idea that just in and of itself, the expression or the exploration of literary ideas, like any of this stuff is in itself, like just net positive. And then sort of throwing that open, that sort of just leaped into the idea of what the reader's role might be in the book. I think you can tell from the way I'm talking that a lot of this is unsettled in me and that I probably don't know exactly what I'm talking about and won't for like a year or two. Like, I think, you know, this is what my books sort of, the relationship I have with my books is that they're just a way of batching off a set of reflections and feelings that I'm interested in putting into an external form of some sort, and that, you know, they make more sense down the track, really. And it's also why I'm really interested in genre fiction, because I don't want that to be boring. Like, you know, if nothing else, if I'm just going to batch up a whole bunch of my bullshit and put it into like an external book, I at least want that thing to be entertaining, you know, irrespective of my own relationship with it.
Well, The Spiral is... it is so delightfully unsettling for the reader. I feel like any reader should want to get into this because it completely changes your relationship as a reader. We are discussing The Spiral. It is Ian Ryan's latest book, and it is fabulous. I mean, Ian, thank you so much for indulging my questions around what you were achieving here. It's been wonderful.
Oh, thank you. Maybe we'll talk again in 2 years and I'll do a better job of it.
You're listening to 2SER 107.3 FM, DAB, on demand, live stream and app.
Thank you for joining me here on 2SER 107.3. My name is Andrew Popel, and look, this is Final Draft, Books, Writing and Literary Culture. It is getting to the pointy end of the show, and I want to say thank you to Ian Ryan. Ian joined me today. We were discussing his new novel, The Spiral, and you might have gotten from that conversation that The Spiral is doing some really interesting, innovative things, and I think as a reader, it exploded my perceptions and really got me thinking. I think this is the sort of thing that every reader hopes that they are going to experience. So look, I really encourage you to go out and check out Ian Ryan's The Spiral. If you want to find out a little bit more before you do that, can I recommend the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast? So every week you're tuning in, hopefully you're catching us on Saturday morning or on Wednesday night, and we are talking books, but it's only for half an hour. And sometimes there's more to the conversations. Ian and I actually had a great chat. We chatted spoilers for The Spiral that, of course, I'm not going to air. But if you want to find out a little bit more, if you've already read, well, then you can go to the podcast and you can get more of that conversation. It is available wherever you listen to podcasts. So if If you're on Pocket Casts, you'll find it. If you've got Spotify, you'll find it. If you're on, you know, Apple, or even if you just want to chuck it in your web browser, you will find Final Draft broadcasting their great conversation, well, our great conversations. Can I also ask you, if you're checking it out, hit subscribe. Hitting subscribe means that you not only get a new conversation every week, you also get any of the bonus episodes that pop up where some extra special stuff comes in. It also helps whatever platform you're listening on know, hey, this is a podcast that is valued, and just lets other people find us. I want to share the book love, and as such, before I let you go, I've got a message from some friends.
Death of the Reader is back for 2021, and we're beginning with Seicho Matsumoto's Inspector Imanishi Investigates.
Everybody's just like really sad because they couldn't find the killer.
I love the idea that they have a party no matter what happens on the case.
They have little party hats on.
Tune in Sunday nights at 9 p.m, Thursdays at 7:30 p.m, or on any of your favorite podcast apps for your Murder Mystery World Tour on 2SER 107.3.
That is Flex and Herds there from the other book show. Not the other book show. There is another book show, though, on 2SER. It is called Death of the Reader. They are back. So do check out Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds also have a podcast, so go and subscribe to that to get the best out of your mysteries. Before I go, I feel like I don't have much time, but I want to share a few dates. Sydney Writers Festival is dropping its program on the 11th of March. The Stella Prize is dropping its long list on the 4th of March. There is so much great book stuff to be excited for. I'm gonna keep you in the loop with that stuff. We're going to be doing some coverage of that. But for today, I got to say goodbye. I'm going to let you go with a track. This is new from Alice Cotton. She is a NT singer-songwriter, and this is called Sleeping Dogs. You've been listening to Final Draft. I'm Andrew Popel. Till next week, happy reading. Bye now.
Look a lot like your mind. You make me wanna play at a time, wanna sing at a tune on that old time song. Four months got me wondering, should I let sleeping dogs alone? Pulling back and forth, 'cause the one I love is not at home. We'll be right back. together anymore.